Project AIDS International, the only group in the world concerned with AIDS that has done anything out front to challenge the monopoly of the pharmaceutical industry, and in this case, AZT. On March 8th and March 9th, represented by lawyer, human rights lawyer, Karen Parker, Project AIDS International had a statement read into the record at the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations in Geneva, leveling a charge that HIV is an unproven virus as far as being the cause of AIDS is concerned, and that at Burroughs Wellcome, a drug called AZT was developed, quote, whose extreme toxicity has called it into question. The statement that was read into the record also mentions a quote by molecular biologist Peter Duisberg stating, this drug will surely kill them, meaning, in this case, babies who are put on AZT.
Now, wasn't Peter Duisberg recently shown, at least by an article in the L.A. Times, a couple of $8 million research projects were undertaken and demonstrated that Peter Duisberg was wrong and that HIV obviously does cause AIDS and not drugs?
Afraid not. That was not the case, although there was an article in the L.A. Times as of last March stating that this was so, but Duisberg's claims were not refuted by these studies. In the first place, unfortunately, they cited a San Francisco cohort study, which I have some inside information about. According to one of the lead researchers, when they interview people, they only ask them as far as drug use is concerned and sexually transmitted diseases, whether they've ever had these diseases or ever used the drugs. They don't go in for quantity, so they have no way of judging the effect of these immunosuppressive factors on people.
So when the study says that you took a group of homosexuals and compared it to a group of homosexuals who got AIDS and heterosexuals who didn't get AIDS, and they said the drug use between the two groups was the same, that doesn't mean anything then?
As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't mean anything, because this is what I was told by one of the researchers on the cohort study, that they never asked for quantity of use. It's also very interesting to note that the one drug that they admit that was not comparable in both of the study groups was poppers, amyl nitrite, which is an extremely carcinogenic drug, which can, of course, cause a tremendous immune suppression.
The room fresheners.
That's right, the room fresheners. Hardware, such trade names as that. So this was an attempt to bash Duisberg on a couple of counts. Duisberg's basic position has been all along that HIV was never proved to cause AIDS, and there's nothing in any of these studies that refutes that or even gets close to refuting it. So they spent $8 million on this when they could have actually been spending the money on trying to research or even tabulate some results from alternative health practices.
Who got the $8
million? Yeah, the researchers, I guess, and looks like University of California at Berkeley got part of the $8 million, too, because one of Duisberg's colleagues was the author of one of the studies. So what happened at the UN is that the representative for Project AIDS International urged a ban on what's called all nucleoside analogs. That means all drugs which are based on the principle of terminating DNA synthesis in the body, DNA being the basic biological molecule of life. AZT does terminate DNA synthesis, as do the other analogs, DDI and DDC. And so we now have this quite incredible statement read out before the United Nations last March 8th and March 9th, and this really is a landmark moment here. And so I want to give out the number of Project AIDS International. It's 213, and write this down. Even if you're asleep, write it on your forehead. 213-857-0809. That's 213-857-0809. And Jeremy Selvey and Mark Lampe over there, who are spearheading this effort, need help. You call that number tomorrow. Just call it and say, what can I do? Because these guys are out in the forefront of leading the fight against, in this case, deadly pharmaceuticals. The next item relates to some information that I've been giving out on the Health News series that has to do with psychiatric murder, I guess we can call it, because that's really what it is. And we are again talking about toxic pharmaceuticals. In this case, for example, some of the neuroleptic drugs, or all of the neuroleptic drugs, which do in fact frequently cause brain damage to those to whom they are administered. And there is a man that you need to remember. You need to remember his name. It's Cesar Martinez. At this moment, he is in a jail in San Salvador, in El Salvador. And the reports that are now coming out of El Salvador is that he may be transferred from the jail that he's in to a psychiatric institution in which doctors will surely do whatever they can to reduce him to somebody who no longer can function, whose brain will no longer be functioning, an effort to discredit his testimony. And I will very briefly tell you who this man is, what he did, and what he said, and then give you another phone number that I want you to call tomorrow without fail. Cesar Martinez worked for Salvadoran Death Squad. He took part in four missions in El Salvador against civilians, which involved the murder of roughly eight people. This was in the early 80s. He was a soldier attached to a brigade in El Salvador and to an intelligence unit within that brigade. And to make a very long and incredible story very short, when he realized the full implications of what he had been doing, he deserted the army and he eventually left El Salvador and wended his way through Guatemala, Belize, Mexico City, and eventually came to the United States, where he testified and gave evidence through a number of bodies, including House committees and Senate committee, and spoke with a number of reporters and indicated that these death squads, which we had heard about, were extremely real. They did function. They were under the control of the El Salvadoran military. The president of the country, Cristiani, knew about them, had come to the barracks of the intelligence unit operating within the brigade in San Salvador. There were American advisors. He himself was in touch with two of these advisors who taught him skills of being an intelligence operative. The operation was financed in American dollars through these American advisors. This was all known. This is the testimony that cracks this whole issue wide open. Of course, all of this has been denied by Salvadoran military people. But Martinez came to the United States and gave testimony in great detail about these operations, about how the soldiers who were part of these operations were continually examined to make sure that they weren't cracking by a psychologist who came in wearing a black hood. Martinez applied for political asylum in the United States in 1989. He was also being prosecuted for illegally entering the country. He was in jail in San Antonio, Texas, for a while. Things were hanging in the balance. There were many people in the country that were vitally interested in his testimony and in bringing it out further into the public, although it was covered by major media. People wanted action on this testimony. They wanted a full-scale investigation across the board. The ultimate result was that Martinez was extradited back into El Salvador. the worst possible thing that could happen. And you have to understand that here is a man who was on the inside. This is not just somebody reporting what he saw, but what he partook of. The most horrible kinds of murders you can imagine are committed by death squads for the purpose of terrorizing the population. It's all part of something called low-intensity warfare, which we heard a lot about in the 80s, a phrase we don't hear very much anymore, but that doesn't mean that it's not used. And the essential idea of low-intensity warfare is an assurance to the civilians of the United States that they themselves won't have to get involved in any serious, large way in waging war. All this can be done through surrogates. And in fact, it's a very strategic kind of enterprise. The Pentagon has people that are in charge of those kinds of operations. And one of the main features of this operation is the terrorizing of local populations in foreign countries where that kind of warfare is being waged. And this is done through death squads. And we have Martinez's testimony that his operation was financed with U.S. dollars and that there were American advisors who knew what was going on the scene there in Salvador. Now what they want to do is take this guy out of jail in Salvador and they want to prosecute him for his operations and these murders as if they were civilian criminal acts that had nothing to do with orders given through the military chain of command. If they do put him into a mental institution over there, those of you that have been listening to some of the health news series will certainly understand what can happen to a person like that. With drugs like Thorazine and other neuroleptic drugs, which actually cut the neural pathways in the brain, the same pathways that lobotomy cuts, you have a situation where a person goes into a kind of vegetative state. This is what's called the dopamine neurotransmitter system in the brain that's cut by these drugs. The symptoms are called tardive dyskinesia, and what that means is a person exhibits all kinds of signs and symptoms of twitching of different parts of his body. Parts of the body go out of control. It's a symptom of greater or lesser brain damage. This is what this man is facing. And regardless of what we would think of him for participating in these death squad activities to begin with, we can understand that this is a person who came all the way to North America, to Washington, D.C., to blow a very loud whistle on all of these activities and to incriminate the guilty. This is not something that he had to do. He could have made his home in other places. He could have assumed other disguises. But he didn't do that. He came forward because it seems that he has understood the horror and the depth of what he participated in. But this is not an attempt to exonerate himself particularly, as much as it seems to be an attempt to get justice and to expose the people who have been involved. But whether I speculate on one side of this or another, the fact is that if he gets out of jail and if he's free and if he can tell his story again and again in greater and greater detail, there is a chance that a true investigation will be undertaken and that we'll really know all the details of these death squad activities and the United States' role in them. So this is a must. This has to happen. More political and public pressure has to be put on. And so what I want you to do is I want you to call Warren Christopher's office. He is the new Secretary of State, and this is his phone number. I want you to write this down. 202-647-6575 during working hours, a human telephone. 202-647-6575. This is in Washington. Now, what you'll get is the Public Relations Department of the State Department. I spoke with a woman there today, and I let her know that people would be calling to say, we want Martinez out of jail in Salvador. We want the State Department and Warren Christopher in particular to put pressure on El Salvador to get this done. and that she can expect phone calls from people. And she said that she would relay, as they do, what people have to recommend and say to Christopher's office. So we need a lot of phone calls on this, and unrelenting. We want Cesar Martinez out of jail. We want him under no coercion. We want him to be able to freely tell his story. He's proved many times in the last 3 or 4 years that he's willing to go to the mat in telling this story. And so there's no reason to suspect that if he gets out, he won't do that. All indications are definitely that he will continue to make this public. So that's a health issue that crosses political boundaries there. And as you'll see in future episodes, shows of Health News, we'll be talking more about psychiatric role in social control and the way it's used and has been used in Nazi Germany. In the United States, people usually think of all of this as only in the Soviet Union, but actually the Nazis invented medical psychiatry to a large extent. It's been imported into the United States and into other countries under a much more benign guise, but that's only a guise. And there's much to say further about that. And as far as, again, I want to give out these phone numbers. Project AIDS International, 213-857-0809. Remember those dates, March 8th and March 9th, 93. Landmark dates, because of Project AIDS International's work, it's now on the record at the United Nations that AZT is a murderous drug. And the number again for Christopher's office for Cesar Martinez, 202-647-6575. And this is John Rappaport for Health News.
Okay, well, want to remind the phone numbers will be at the KPFK switchboard and all day and for weeks from 9 to 5. And since you're here live, would you like to maybe take a few phone calls? I'm sure we've been having health news almost every week, and there may be some response or
sure
criticism or whatever.
Whatever.
Okay, well, if you want to talk to John, we are at, well, you know where we're at, 818-985-KPFK. If you want to talk to John Rappaport directly, and of course, just keep ringing, and we will answer the phone live on the air. If the phone company unplugs you, they don't like you to ring too long, and you just have to try to call back again. We find that preferable to making people stay on hold for a half an hour or an hour and maybe not even getting in. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to commend you for having John Rappaport. I've been listening to the whole series. As a matter of fact, I have the whole series of health news that he's been doing. What I would like to also ask, I'm also like to deal with what role does sugar in the processing of food and the effects, the physical, psychological effects that food, that sugar has on the general health of various individuals, and does this play a role in social control?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sugar and social control. Write a book. I think that's a great idea. Well, my feeling on that is that, first of all, when people start recovering from illnesses and diseases and they start to put their diet straight, one of the first obvious things that they need to knock out is sugar, because that's going to keep you in a very debilitated state. And the way it was described to me is the following. If the body is moving in sugar, you're talking about a very volatile form of energy. It comes into the system, it's moved out of the system. It comes into the system, it's moved out of the system. It's very fast freight. It's not being released slowly into the system for energy the way it's supposed to come through regular food, right? And so it debilitates people completely, and it makes them unable to think as clearly as they need to think, and it keeps people in a kind of, you know, sort of a half-light state.
So then it's obvious that the people who put this product in every food product almost available, and especially in the supermarkets, obviously they're aware of this, or they have to be aware of these effects that they have, but yet they push it. It's in everything that most people consume.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I mean, this is a very fertile area for investigation, obviously. This is a really interesting thing you're bringing up here. But one thing I can say for sure is when a large corporation discovers that people can be legally addicted to something, what could possibly stand in their way of trying to do it? Nothing, because it's almost like guaranteed dollars. I mean, when you've got somebody hooked on a substance that there's no law against, you know that your profit is guaranteed for eternity.
Well, absolutely.
So why shouldn't? I mean, you know, this is what you could call business as usual. I mean, this is the way people operate. And if morphine were legal, you can bet that corporations would get behind that and try to figure out every possible way to get people hooked onto that. So what we have that's legal now is sugar. And it does definitely... I'm glad you brought this up. This
I would say it also has a definite role in the whole formation of a lot of the diseases and the cancer that I'm sure it has a role that it plays in the overall debilitating health effects, especially diseases.
I would agree with you, and I'd also say that it's criminal that not enough research has ever been done on this to put it all together. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we know why, because nobody's going to fund that kind of research.
Oh, absolutely.
But we could have by now, I'm sure, discovered... I mean, there are links that have been drawn in studies, no question about it. This is not unknown territory by any means. But there could have been a lot more done and a lot more put in front of the public to show the links between sugar and disease. But unfortunately, it's an issue for consumers because the government is certainly not going to make an announcement. In fact, here's an interesting story. I remember when I was writing AIDS, Inc., that there was a doctor in Tennessee during the polio epidemics of the early 50s, who decided that the reason that the kids were in summer was because it was hot and because they were drinking soda pop. This is way back there. So as a public health officer in his area, he began promoting the idea that parents should not allow their kids to drink soda pop in the summer. And the incidence of polio went way, way down that summer. And this guy was practically drummed out of the Corps. I mean, he was ostracized and made to look like a fool.
Uh-huh.
Right? So...
he had came across something.
Yeah, right.
Now, one quick question, and then I'll let you...
Then the incidence of polio went up the year after he was kicked out.
Yeah. Exactly.
Also, I would also argue that sugar plays a significant role in psychiatry and the fact that people have various so-called psychological problems and whatnot. It's probably because of the malfunctioning of the body's ability to handle this type of processed refined sugar, causing a hypoglycemic condition, which the so-called psychiatrists or psychiatric profession treats from a medical drug standpoint, but really they're dealing with something that's just debilitating from the body from a processed refined standpoint, but they're treating it as a mental problem.
You're a mind reader, whoever you are, because last night I did a taped interview that will eventually get played as one of the health news series with a woman who was hypoglycemic and described exactly what you're talking about, a whole host of symptoms, low blood sugar leading to what would ordinarily be thought of as semi-severe psychiatric symptoms, and was actually treated by a psychiatrist. And eventually, she discovered, when she realized that she had hypoglycemia, that by going on another kind of a diet altogether, a healthy diet, that the symptoms disappeared. And so she wasn't quite sure whether it was the psychiatrist or the diet because it was new to her. And she continued to go to the psychiatrist, but then discovered that every time she'd fall off the diet, the symptoms would all come back. Right? So you're absolutely right. There are a whole host of emotional kinds of, you know, flare-ups and what you would call possibly irrational irritabilities and all that sort of thing, you know, that could lead to definite psychiatric drugs. The shrinks would definitely say, well, you're depressed or this or anxiety, and, you know, we'll give you Xanax or whatever, which can be wiped out by the use of nutrition.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good show, Roy. Hi, John.
Hi.
Yeah, sugar really plays into it. I think if you look back historically at the situation, I've got into this pretty heavy, and sugar made its presence on the planet on the Solomon Islands about thousands and thousands of years ago, and some seagoing Chinese herbalists discovered it and brought it back to the mainland, and they cultivated it. At that time, they called it stone honey. And then I think people like Marco Polo, when they were bringing, quote, spices into Europe, I think they, one of the main ones was probably this stone honey that became increasingly processed down to where they took out all the B vitamins. And then, to me, a European domination of the planet is nothing more than the hypoglycemic desire forevermore. The conquistadors were perfect examples of hypoglycemia. They were never satisfied. They always wanted more sex, more gold, more domination over people. And then when you had the influence of the African Americans coming to America, the sugar didn't go down that way very much. But then they were brought here to cultivate sugar. The first slaves were brought to process sugar and stuff. And then you had, before that, you had Columbus. And in my mind, he was a hopeful drug merchant, and he was looking for India. And what was India? India was the place where the sugar was being processed. It went from China into India. That Kublai Khan dynasty in China, they were big on sugar. And he was the dynasty that Marco Polo was going to visit.
The unrecognized drug of our time, eh?
Yeah, and if you look at how it burns, you got simple carbohydrates like sugar and white flours. They burn like dry grass in the body. Then you got complex carbohydrates like grains, whole grains. They burn like sticks. And then you got heavy protein like soy or even meat, and that burns like logs. So if you eat too much of the simple carbohydrates, even if it's honey or flour, it just starts burning up your system and you can't handle it, and it fries your neurocircuitry, and then no wonder people are going to doctors and getting all these narcoleptic drugs and stuff, you know?
This is very dear to my heart, this whole issue here, because one of the things that I get into successively, whatever the right word is there, in future shows on Health News that are already taped, but you haven't heard them yet, is this whole idea that we have this medical system. Okay, we all know that it focuses on symptoms basically only, and we know there are underlying causes, but when you begin to really home in on the idea that what the symptoms are symptoms of are quite often nutrition that's completely screwed up.
Yeah.
And then it just doesn't just become superficial, it becomes criminal, because by now there are enough researchers and scientists in this country that know that the great untold and suppressed story of medicine in this country is that nutrition works.
Yeah.
And that if you were to emphasize that, you wouldn't need a great deal of this medical system if you did it from birth.
Yeah.
And that is a fact that must never be let out into the sunlight, because that will destroy the monopoly.
That's right. And what you were talking about there with the sugar and the polio, I think you were referring to that the work by the guy that wrote the book Food is Your Best Medicine. And it was sugar and dairy products. It was ice cream, because the kids were eating a lot of ice cream in the summer.
That's right.
And whenever you process dairy, now dairy is another thing. If you look at dairy is basically cow lymphatic fluid that's filtered through the tits, and lymphatic fluid is like, it's basically mucus. So it's like thinned down cow mucus. Cheese is nothing more than like cow snot, and when you heat that or freeze it, it changes the structure. It's called hydrophilic colloid, which is the protein structure when it's in its raw state, and when you heat it, it changes it into something, I think he was calling it hydrophobic colloid, and your body doesn't know what the hell to do with it, and these saturated fats, they get gunked in your system, and they coat the fine-tuning sensitive receiving antenna that's in our brains, that's in our nervous system. It gets coated by this stuff, and we just end up insulated from our sense of God presence. We end up living in cities with low oxygen, and it's just like rats. You confine rats, and they start fighting and eating and shooting. They would shoot each other if they had guns, probably. But on the human level, it's like we're living in low oxygen, and it's like we're rats. And if we could somehow get rid of this fascist scab, which I think it is naturally a fascist scab, and just like if you burnt your body, there would be scum rising to the top of that burn, and it would scab over, and underneath, person by person, molecule by molecule, the healing would go on, and the scab would just kind of flake away. And I think that's what's happening now, is we're spreading this information with people like you and Roy, I think, are like white blood cells in this planetary being. And with the information going around, person by person, molecule by molecule, city by city, we're going to get this planet to where it's so healthy underneath that this fascist scab will just flake away on its own, you know?
That's quite an image. I have to say that if you look at the pharmaceutical companies, which are, of course, chemical companies, which are pesticide companies, which are agricultural seed companies, which are engineering of seed companies, and you begin to think in terms of how they're planning our future, a very toxic future indeed, and then you begin to think about how to deal with that.
Yeah.
You say, well, if I just wanted to do something purely political, it would be very simple.
Yeah.
All I would have to do is eat organic produce, stop eating meat, and go for, with all the growth hormones and the antibiotics and everything put into it, and stop taking pharmaceutical drugs, except in a certain absolute emergencies, possibly, and those companies would go broke.
Yeah.
Now, if enough people did that, those companies would go broke.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, what would happen to the people who did it is they would get healthy.
I know.
What a deal.
Right. It's exactly what's happening. It's a big scab, and the work you're doing, it's like you can trim off the dead skin of these wounds, but if you start picking the scab, then it makes it worse. So what we need to do is spread this information around, which is what's happening, and then the scab is just going to flake away quite naturally. Because I know the disease is a call to higher consciousness. I was dosed in Nam. I got sprayed with Agent Orange and stuff, and I was sick as hell. And it's been something that's been a wake-up call to me, and I wouldn't trade the knowledge and everything that I've gotten so far from the problem that I've been through, and I've been through like hell. But I've learned all this stuff from a lot from Roy and Ed and different people, and I'm doing ozone now, and I can feel it when I'm doing it, and I'm injecting 60 cc's in my veins. And it goes to areas in my body where I got these toxic waste dumps, and I can feel the burn. And I know what's happening. It's just oxidizing this crap, and my body's able to get rid of it. And I can do things like colon cleansers, and it works wonderfully. And I don't want to take up any more time, but thanks a lot for the work you guys are doing, and God bless.
Thanks for your fantastic information-packed call.
Really.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, KPFK. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. John, I was wondering, you touched on it a little bit in previous call. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about this genetic engineering fruits and vegetables that are going to be hitting the shelves or are on the shelves, and what we can do or I can do to protect myself or be aware. You know, there's certain stores we can go to, but I hear that it's not really going to be regulated and the information isn't going to be out there. Not that I would want the FDA regulating this, but, you know,
Right, but you would want labels, and
I would
so
want
far
to know.
It looks like there's not going to be any labels.
Yeah.
This is yet another reason to be demanding organic produce, because the chances are quite high that if you've got a farmer that's growing organically, he's probably not going to be using any of these genes. And especially if you can buy from local stores that have organic produce and ask them about their farmers, there is something called community-supported agriculture. I'm afraid I don't have the number with me, but it is on one of the shows. And there's a ranch called the Moore Ranch. And I believe it's up in Carpinteria, California. And they have a wonderful system of organic growing and biodynamic management of the soil. And people buy shares in that farm. And for a share of the farm, the ownership, you get delivered in Los Angeles crates of produce every week, organic produce grown in biodynamic soil. And this movement of farms is spreading across the country. Supposedly there are about 75 of these now that are run in this way. So the ultimate solution to this, in my mind, is this kind of thing. In other words, a permanent boycott. As far as what is going to be happening, I can tell you that, and this I go into in some detail in another health news show, the major genetic, quote, breakthrough that's been engineered by the 8 largest pesticide companies in the world, and I can give you at least some of their names, Hecht, a German pharmaceutical company, ICI, which is Imperial Chemical Industries in Britain, Bayer, Ciba Geigy, and all of these are drug companies, by the way, as well. And then we have the wonderful DuPont, Monsanto, Dow trio in the United States, and Rhône-Poulenc, a French company. These are the 8 largest pesticide companies in the world, all drug companies. And they are engineering crops so that they will absorb more pesticides. This is the first major genetic breakthrough in agriculture. Not what we've been told to expect. This is what's happening, and it's all to sell more pesticide. So an example I'll give you is a company, American Cyanamid, develops a gene that will allow crops to tolerate the pesticide that they manufacture, which I believe is called glyphosate. They go to Pioneer Hybrid, which is the largest corn breeder in the world, and they say, we're going to give you this gene to insert in your corn for nothing. You can have it for free. The thing is, it'll allow this corn to tolerate more of our glyphosate pesticide. And Pioneer says, great, we'll take it. And so it's a way of locking in pesticide sales and drenching the soil with pesticides and the crops with pesticides and people with pesticides. So this is what these 8 largest companies are doing now. 7 of them have been identified in at least one book called World Without Cancer by Ed Griffin as being firms that at one time or another had dealings with IG Farben, which is the famous Nazi cartel, the largest chemical cartel in history. So this is part of the future that's being planned for us, and I wouldn't count on knowing at every step what the food is that's got the genes and the food that doesn't have the genes.
Yeah, that's my next question is how...
So you buy organic.
Well, and how do I trust that all the time? I mean, that's
well,
the next
it's a
question.
It's a good start. It's a good start, I'd say. And if you get to know your local grocer, if you really want to get into this, you're going to engage your local grocer in a dialogue. In other words, instead of treating him like another corporation, you're going to go in there and start talking to him and saying, look, I want to sit down with you and I want to find out who these farmers are, because I am potentially a lifetime customer at this store if I'm convinced that the guys you're dealing with are growing good food and it doesn't have genes in it.
And if I live longer, I'll
right.
buy more food.
Or
right?
You get in touch with community-supported agriculture at the Moore Farm and you talk to Moore, and I'm sorry I don't have the number with me, but it will be on a later show, and you start finding out about that kind of thing.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening, Joe. Bye.
Bye. I think John is probably only telling part of the story, and we have to be fair to the companies here and give the rest of the story. But I, I imagine that the other part of this deal that you're leaving out is that they're working on DNA research to produce human beings who are able in the next generation to tolerate more pesticides through DNA research.
I'm sure that they're doing it as we speak.
So
I'm sure they're doing it.
Other part
that's
of it.
The other half of the equation, all right.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I hope I'm not being too repetitive to regular listeners, but I have been trying for the longest time to find out about this idea of HIV not being the cause of AIDS, and so about that at the beginning. I wonder if you could just briefly talk about that idea, maybe that specific doctor's study that was trashed in the LA Times.
Okay, I'll try to boil. I can't boil it down to a couple of minutes, but I'll just.
And maybe the name of a book too that gives that information.
Yeah, AIDS Inc. is a book that I wrote 4 years ago. It's just come back into the bookstores. You can certainly get it at the Phoenix or the Mandala in Santa Monica, and the books are in now. And it takes up this whole thing in great detail. But basically, there are certain rules that the orthodox medical researchers go by in proving a germ causes a disease, and they haven't obeyed those rules, their own rules. Whether or not you agree with the rules or whatever, they have strayed a great distance from them. And in essence, what they have done is found that there is some correlation between people who have antibodies to a virus called HIV and who eventually develop immune suppression, some correlation. What that really means, though, is to infer from that they have found the cause of something called AIDS is, I'll just have to say, trust me for the moment, a monumental leap of faith, to say the least. And antibodies normally being a sign that a person has developed immunity, or at the very least has simply contacted a germ, but does not describe any sort of disease condition. And as proof of that, the people that are now receiving experimental AIDS vaccines are told that when they finish the studies, they will become permanently HIV positive, and they will be given a letter so that if they're ever examined by a doctor who gives them an HIV test and they show up positive, he must not tell them that they're going to get AIDS and die. He can look at the letter and say, oh, my son, you've been vaccinated, and that's why you have antibodies to HIV. Wonderful. You're fine. Now you're immune. At which point, such a person could very easily stare into his doctor's eyes and say, pal, what difference does it make whether I'm HIV positive, which means I have antibodies to HIV, or they just gave me the vaccine, which makes me have antibodies? And there is no good answer to that question.
I want to say at this point that you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, and we are on the air live with John Rappaport as of March 17th, 1993. And
John. Can I just follow up a little bit? I'm just curious about then alternate ideas of the causes of AIDS, like why it has suddenly about if it's not HIV.
Yes, that's another very long story.
I have the seal, the North Sea Seals story, and that parallels it, that simplifies it. A few years ago, there's hundreds or thousands of seals were washing up dead on the shores of Europe in the North Sea. And according to a newspaper article I read in the Times, the scientists were mystified why all these dead seals were dying and washing up on the shore of the North Sea, where they dump nuclear waste and they dump toxic waste and they dump gasoline and oil waste and chemical waste, and then these seals are dying. So the plan was to autopsy the seals, find out what virus was killing them, and to make a vaccine and to inoculate the live seals against the virus that's killing them. That's the parallel situation to the AIDS virus. And I might add, when John John's research was written up in his book AIDS, Inc. in 1987. The two leading numero uno leaders in the world of HIV causation were Dr. Robert Gallo, who has recently been found guilty of scientific misconduct and knocked out of the Nobel Prize box for stealing the HIV virus from Dr. Luc Montagnier of the Pasteur Institute, and Dr. Luc Montagnier of the Pasteur Institute, who discovered HIV virus, who has since recently in the last year or two come out saying that the HIV evidently doesn't cause AIDS after all. It needs something else, maybe another virus.
Well, is it your view that there is something that is contagious that passes from person to person that is not HIV, or that is simply an environmental condition that is coming to a head at this point? Or, and I realize this is a long question you couldn't get into. I'm just trying to get an idea of direction.
Okay, well, the direction is, if you read AIDS, Inc., you'll see what my answer to that is. But in short, it's that AIDS is not one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a number of different immune-suppressed conditions in different groups around the world, and within those groups in different individuals. And whether or not there could be a contagious element, one of the leading candidates for that would be undiagnosed and chemically suppressed syphilis,
mm-hmm.
which in certain cases could be accounting for what's being called AIDS, but certainly from my research could not possibly account for everything that's being called AIDS. We'd be looking at a number of different ways in which the immune system could be suppressed, and that's what I think you'll find when you read the book.
Okay, well, I'll get the book. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And the book is available wherever health books are sold.
Hello?
And hi, and particularly we do know it is being stocked.